Thank you very much. Thank you all of you for holding all the way to the last speaker of the day. I have changed, if you have seen the program, I've changed my title. I've decided to do something completely different for two reasons. One is that Marios Christodoulos is going to talk about the topic I wanted to talk, a concrete possibility to measure discreteness of quantum discreteness of time. And the second, but the main reason I decided to change my talk is because listening to this conference has been great, because there are so many different perspectives and views, and frustrating at the same time, because I suppose is happening to many of the people here from different perspectives, but precisely because we come from different backgrounds, we know little about one another. So something are new and super interesting, something are strange, hard to digest. But also one has often the feeling that different communities are unaware of what has happened in other communities. So I decided to go back to basics. And I thought it was more useful to say the way, at least I understand, the outcome of several decades, I would say, of discussions about the nature of time in quantum gravity, so the quantum nature of time that have happened in the quantum gravity community, in the non-perturbative quantum gravity community. So I'm going to illustrate what I think it's at least my way of viewing how one thinks about time in this community. And this is largely in my 2004 book, Quantum Gravity, which actually has a long part which is not quantum, and the substantial part which is not gravity, in which I address a lot of the conceptual issues that were discussed in this conference. I try to summarize the result of years of discussions. I'm not going to give any reference in this short talk, because these are things which are been developed by so many people and also exist in many variants. So I'm just giving one of the many variants. Seem all similar and different in differing in details. Let me start by saying something strongly. Harvey this morning made this point. When we talk about time and the issue of time, we're talking about so many different things. I mean, time itself, we use the expression time for so many different things. So it's deeply wrong, I think, to say what is time, which time. There are so many different notions of time we use even in our day life. The idea that there is one thing which is time, which can be understood just in one equation, one structure, one thing, it's misleading. In fact, my book, The Order of Time, it's a book, it's a popular book, but it's all about taking apart all these different meanings of time. But specifically, I want to make a distinction, which is a distinction, we also heard about this point in the last talk, but it's a distinction which is in the Principia, which I want to stress is not two different theories of time. It's just two different notions of times, which they are both good. And Newton says it so clearly. Newton does not say relational time is wrong, my absolute time is right. Newton says there is one notion of time, which is the traditional notion of time, all the way to Newton. So the everyday notion of time, day, night, which Aristotle was mentioned in the last talk, formalized, but it's a common way of time, which is just counting the things that happen, right? Sunset, sunrise, and so on. This is what we mean by time. We also can count in particular the step of a clock, but not necessarily so everything, just a succession of things that happen and counting them and calling this happening time. A completely different idea is the hypothesis that Newton introduced of a time flowing by itself, uniform, independently of everything that happened. But I want to stress the fact that Newton never said that his idea of time it takes away the other. And this is very important, because when we go to quantum gravity, and that will be sort of my arrival point, the natural idea of time will remain exactly the same. It's not changed. We can still count events 1, 2, 3, 4 locally and say, well, time is passing because this is happening, this other thing is happening. There's no metric, there's nothing global, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's a Newtonian specific structure of time, which of course changes in special relativity, changes in general relativity, and changes in quantum gravity. So the change of the nature of time in quantum gravity are far less radical than the way we like to put in popularization thing, oh my God, there's no time. The usual time is there. It's a Newtonian time that changes. All right, so what do we need to do quantum gravity? Well, this is the key point. One way of thinking about evolution, and Emily this morning put it very clearly, is to think that we describe reality by variables, Qn, that evolves in time. I call time T with a capital T here. Whatever formulas you like better, this is the dynamical evolutions written with a Poisson bracket. You can write Hamilton equations or Newton equations. You have things evolving in time, okay? And how do we compare with experiments where we have these are numbers, so we need an apparatus that transforms some variables in number, Qn, and then a clock that transforms this T in number somehow that measure time. Now, I want to stress as strongly as I can, this logic of thinking about the world.
Carlo, we still see only your first slide, at least I see only the very first slide.
Really?
Well, I don't know for the others, but for me, for sure.
Yeah, it's only the first slide.
Yeah. Something has gone wrong. I stop sharing and start again. Did you see this one?
Now I see nothing.
Yeah, it's black.
You just said that your status is screen sharing, so maybe we just have to wait until you have succeeded.
It says you are screen sharing. Here is just the standard. On my side, everything seems to be normal.
We just see a black screen.
And the point I want to make is the traditional one remains also in quantum gravity. The Newtonian one is going to change. Now, this is a new slide. I hope you see it. There is just the Hamilton equation of motion equated with a Poisson bracket, and the idea that we describe nature as a variable evolving in time. And the key point is that this does not work anymore in general relativity. So for a relativist who has studied general relativity, who has used it, who work in gravitational waves, who work in... this is not the way you think about the world. You cannot think about the world as evolution in time. And Emily this morning was talking about alternatives to that. Now, let me make it clear here. Of course, there is a coordinate time in general relativity. You have coordinates, and one of them you can call x0, t, the coordinate time. But as Einstein put it, very clearly, I mean, he said the difficulty of general relativity was his struggle with the meaning of the coordinates. The coordinates do not correspond to the reading of rods and clock, okay? Have no direct empirical measurable meaning whatsoever unless you add equations, you attach them to something. Of course, you have clocks, and because the nature is the same with clocks, and clock, the reading of a clock is given by t, which is the line integral of the line element, so the square root of GAB DXA DXB. So this is a clock, but it's completely different than the independent variable of common evolution, because between some events, this event here and this event here, there are different time intervals depend on where you how you move. And just to make it clearly and strongly for those who didn't spend their life in general relativity, if you have two clocks in your two hands and you throw one upward and you catch it back, okay, if the two clocks indicated the same time before, when they later they indicate a different time, right? Question, which one is earlier? Special relativity gives one result, general relativity gives the opposite result. Try. Which one is the right clock? Well, none, of course, right? Neither is the right clock. If you want the longest possible is the one you throw up. The geodetic is the one that throw up. You can choose, or the static one is the one you don't throw up. So is it one time more than another? No, they are just two perfectly good notions of time, perfectly equivalent, good for one reason one, good for another reason the other. I can list advantages of one the other, but they are just two equally notion of time. So therefore, the idea of describing reality's evolution in a single time variable, it just clashes with the facts of nature. Okay, so how do we get out of this? Well, it's not too complicated. We just rethink evolution, not as variables in terms of a single parameter t, but as variable, as evolution, as relative evolution of variables. So you describe how the q variables change with respect t, how t respect change with respect to t prime, and so on and so forth. And this can be formalized in many possible ways. This is the one, many more or less analogous ways. This is the one I like best. This is in the book, as it's not so much mine, is just taken from dozens of people. Some are here in the audience that in one way contribute to that. So the old way of thinking is that you have the variables, you have time, the evolution, and the equations. The new way of thinking is that you have a larger set of variables that include all the possible times that you have around. Okay, one clock, another clock, or whatever other things you want to use as clocks. And so instead, look at the two pictures, instead of thinking about evolution as evolution of a variable in a time, so a function and function other, so a variable function another variable, you just think of relations between variables, one being q, the other being t, and the other t's, the other q's, which you give just as a some function of this variable equal to zero, or a set of function of this variable equal to zero. And this can be generalized by demanding, if you have a phase space structure among your variables, that the Poisson bracket of a constraint with this quantity is zero. In particular, if you want to go back to the previous case, you just take as a constraint the variable conjugated to your time variable plus the Hamiltonian, and immediately this gives back the Hamilton equations, right? Now, the key point here is that there's nothing frozen in that. And people say, oh my God, there is a constraint. Oh my God, there is a Wheeler-Weyl equation. There's no more time. There's no more evolution. Of course, there's evolution. We're doing exactly the same thing as before. We're just changing language. We're just avoiding saying which variable is the independent one in the evolution. But we're describing the same nature that changes, jumps, changes as before in a language where we don't say a priori which one of the variables is playing the role of the clock, because in generativity there isn't a preferred variable that plays the role of the clock. All this was classical. Now let's take this deep insight, it's not my insight, it's Einstein's insight, and use it in quantum mechanics, and you can do exactly the same thing. Instead of doing evolution in time, you do relative evolution of variables. So this is quantum mechanics on the left as evolution in time. You have non-commutative variables that, you know, you can just take as non-commutative variables, or you can concretely realize as operator in a Hilbert space. You have a time variable, special, specific, different from anything else, and you evolve your operators in time with the Heisenberg equation of motion, or if you want to introduce a Hilbert space, you turn the evolution into the states and you get a Schrödinger equation. And of course, you don't get trajectory anymore, but you can compute given some particle in some position, some variables at some time, you can compute the probability distribution, the probability, say, for given some other variable at some time. It's a distribution. If this is a continuous spectrum, you have to put the dots on the I. Now, how do you do in the case in which you don't have time? Well, you just include the time to your algebra observables, which now, if you want to realize this operator, are on some bigger Hilbert space. It's not the previous Hilbert space. It's bigger because there's a time inside all the times you have. You have the same evolutions as the same equation of motion as in the classical theory. This is quantum mechanics, right? It's just quantum classical theory variables plus non-commutativity. And therefore, you have this constraint, and you can view this constraint on the state, on k, right? So you have this equation here, cpc equals zero, which is a Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which of course, if the constraint is just as I said, the conjugate variable to the time plus Hamiltonian, you get the Schrödinger equation. So the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is not an evolution equation, and the Schrödinger equation is an evolution equation. They're both evolution equation, right? There's no need to go Page, Wouter, magic, interference. It's exactly like in the classical theory. It's just another way of saying the same thing, which is slightly more general, because it allows us not to pinpoint with a finger, this is time. But to do physics, we don't have to say, oh, pinpoint with a finger, this is time. We have variables that evolve, that change one with respect to the other, right? So how do you actually compute this transition amplitude? Well, the way which I think is far more clear is the following. The set of partial observables, I call them, so your variables, including the time variables, live on this larger Hilbert space K. On this Hilbert space, you can diagonalize this operator and get eigenstates, which sort of represent you measuring a particle at some time, for instance. The constraint equation defines a subspace of the extended Hilbert space, which is a proper subspace if the eigenstate, if the eigenvalue zero is discrete, otherwise is a generalized subspace. So you have to use distribution theory, you have to do things a little bit cleanly. But in all cases, you can cleanly define a projection from K to H, which is like, you know, this is space of all wave functions, this is a solution of the Schrödinger equation, essentially. So you project it down, and you the transition amplitude given by the matrix element of this projector here, generalized projector here. Ashtekar Abai calls it the extractor. And one way of doing this P is so-called group averaging. So you exponentiate this and integrate from minus infinity to plus infinity. So you have transition amplitudes without ever saying which one is your time variable. And if in particular, let's as usual go back to the usual case, C has this form here, and you do a one particle, then as I said, K is a space of all L2 of R2 functions of X and T. Okay, you have to suitably enlarge distribution sense to find H. And you do the calculation and you find out that the transition amplitude from xt to x prime t prime, the matrix element of this thing here, are exactly the usual transition for going from x to x prime in a time t minus t prime. So this is quantum mechanics, slightly generalization quantum mechanics in a language large enough to include general relativity. Now let's do it for general relativity. And I do it in one slide formal, and in the next slide, for real, without ill-defined questions. So this is the formal way. It goes back to the 60s. You have the geometry of a three slide, a three-dimensional metric, and you understand this as operators acting on a space. You have a constraint, which is the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, the actual Wheeler-DeWitt equation of the 60s. And you have transition amplitudes that, again, you can formally define, because you cannot do the calculations in this language, as the matrix element of the projector, which you can formally write as an integral of the four geometries. Now, the interesting thing is that how can you do that so this is well defined? Well, this is space-time. This is a three-dimensional surface where you have one of the two, three metrics. This is another three-dimensional surface where you have the other of the two, three metrics. And you know from Hamilton-Jacobi formulation of classical relativity that this is a well-posed way of writing the Einstein equation as evolution sort of from the intrinsic-extrinsic geometry here to the extrinsic-extrinsic geometry here. In the quantum theory, the amplitude is given by the integration of the four-dimensional metric inside. So inside, you're summing over all metrics, like in the particle case, you're summing over all trajectory. This is formal, but this can be done non-formally in loop quantum gravity. In loop quantum gravity,
10 minutes plus questions.
Great. In loop quantum gravity, you have the operator acting on a Hilbert space, which are well-defined, and you have these transition amplitudes, which I'm not going to describe, which are specifically the sum over geometry. I mean, you can think intuitively as a sum over geometry. these equations are well-defined and this silver space is well-defined. So for instance, this is the kind of calculation we're doing now. Think of a black hole that forms. It enters a quantum region and then it makes a transition to whatever happened next. Here is quantum gravity and this transition amplitude give you the probability amplitude for going from one metric to the other. Good. So this was a technical part. Now in the last 2 minutes, let me just, on the light of that, discuss many, just mention many of the issues appearing in this conference. First, where is the time variable? Answer, which time variable? In generativity, there are all sorts of time variables, right? There's cosmological time, there's killing time, there is proper time, there's coordinate time. It's not that one of these is the time. They're just, you know, many, many different things. We have probabilities. Probability is the theory. The theory gives transition amplitude for something to something. Where is evolution? Evolution is completely included in the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, properly understood, that defines the transition amplitude without need to do any strange thing. Just learn general relativity, and you see how the transition from three metric to three metric is an evolution in time. Is the causal structure fixed? Of course it's not, because we're integrating over all possible geometry. I mean, there's no causal structure. It's just a fluctuating causal structure. Why should it be fixed? In some classical, I'm not saying that there's no open interesting question to address here. Some classical limit you want the causal structure to reemerge. You want to know whether something cannot propagate from here to there in some sense, but in the full theory, there's no causal structure fixed. Do we know quantum reference frame? Not to say that the current work on quantum reference frame is not interesting, it's extremely interesting, but it's not needed necessarily in quantum gravity because there are no coordinates. The first thing you want to do is get rid of the coordinate, get rid of t, get rid of the x variables, and work with quantities which you can sort of observe and attach a measurement to. Is the geometry locally flat? Well, it's better in some limit, but certainly not in the small quantum size limit because geometry fluctuates there explicitly. And is there a manifold? Of course there's no manifold because the manifold is the first thing abandoned. I mean, Heisenberg first thing said, forget about the trajectory of the electron. If you keep thinking about the trajectory of an electron, you don't get quantum mechanics cleanly. So there's no manifold. Now, how do we make measurement? Now in quantum mechanics, you always have most of interpretation of quantum mechanics, if not all, under a careful discussion, you always have the Heisenberg cat between the system you're observing and what you're observing from or what is being affected by. In general relativity, systems are localized with respect to the external space. The beauty of quantum gravity is that it allows you to identify the space-time boundary with a Heisenberg cat. You saw what happened in the black hole here. The system is a portion of space-time, okay, not the portion of space, which behaves quantum mechanically, and quantum mechanics gives you transitional amplitude for going from here to here. Or if you want the in Emily language, the constraints on the probabilities between what is happening here and what is happening there. Sorry, go back to the slide I was using, this one. Does space-time emerge? Well, time doesn't emerge in the usual sense of time. I mean, things happen and you can count them. Space does not emerge in the usual sense of space. There are things which are nearby and things which are not nearby. But of course, in the general relativistic or the Newtonian sense of a continuous space-time manifold, of course it emerges. How does it emerge? In the completely conventional way in which classical things emerge from a quantum thing, the same sense in which the trajectory emerges from the quantum dynamics of a particle or electromagnetic waves emerge from the photons. But what is time? All sorts of things. Is the name to give to things that the fact that events happen? Of course they happen in quantum gravity. Why shouldn't they? Is the way of counting events one after the other one? Of course. I mean, we can do a transition from A to B, from B to C, from C to D, and so on. Is the reading of a clock Sure, in GR, there are many possible clock. In quantum mechanics, you just couple some matter system that is clocky, and that's the reading of a clock. It's a complete ordering of the events? Of course, no, because we learned from special relativity that nature doesn't need, doesn't care, doesn't want a complete ordering of events, and so on and so forth. Newtonian space-time, it's only an approximation. Last line, what about the orientation of time? Well, this has nothing to do with classical mechanics, nothing to do with quantum mechanics. It's a beautiful, fantastic open problem that has to do with macroscopic systems, why the entropy was low in the past and things like that. It's not something that should be confused. And this is my last slide. The title of the conference is Quantum Time. So time variables are many. Many clocks, they're measurable, they're on the same footing on the other variables. We can attach measurement to them. So in that sense, and we have heard Lorenzo, many others doing a careful way of thinking at time as measured by clock as a variable, which has property, and we can ask questions about them. There's nothing frozen, I keep saying it, in the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. We don't need Page Wooder. We just need understanding general relativity to understand what happened to time evolution. Time evolution is relative. It's one variable with respect to the other, not evolution of all the metric and matter fields in the coordinate time. So the coordinate time disappear. Good, we don't need it. There's no mystery about the emergence of time, no more mystery than the emergence of electromagnetic field from the space of photons of QED. And the key aspect of quantum object in general, the key phenomena, if you want, are superposition, fuzziness in the small and discreteness. And of course, we expect them for time and for space-time. We can have two events along the same path, the same world line, and a superposition of proper times. And this is exactly what is being the general relativist, the quantum general relativistic way of interpreting the gravity entangled phenomena that are being probably measurable soon in the laboratory. We hope there was a conference last week. Time is fuzzy in the small because every variable don't commute with others in the small. So if you determine the other is fuzzy, and it's discrete. And we expect it to be discrete. It's not easy to do a calculation in loop quantum gravity to pinpoint this. In fact, we don't have one completely clear, but it might even be that there's a possibility of measuring this discreteness, and Marios Christodoulou is gonna, that's what I would have liked to talk, I mean, but Marios is gonna talk about that. So let me stop here. I rushed because I hope to get some questions.
Thank you so much, Carlo. You perfectly finished on time. This was a very interesting talk. And I can see we have two questions. We can start with Lorenzo.
Okay, thank you very much. So I think there might be, I agree with you, some communication issues when we talk between different fields. But I think I agree with everything you said. So. I certainly do not believe there's any magic in Page and Wooters. And the fact, I understand that people from other fields may be upset that we keep on referring to Page and Wooters when there is a huge literature even before that. And I did mention it in my talk and in my papers. So we are aware of that. I guess we do like Page and Wooters' paper because I think they're the first to really point out the importance of entanglement, which, of course, for people in our field is a very important issue. But okay, that's enough of discussing this.
An answer to this, Lorenzo.
I actually have a real question, but.
Yeah, let me answer. It's a very beautiful paper, the one with Page and Wooter. I don't want to talk bad of it. Right. A very nice paper. I remember reading it with enormous interest. There's no inconsistency with what I said and with what you do. at all. I think Philip Hearn has a very nice way of seeing the same thing from different perspective and a different language and bringing everything together. The point is that it is often quoted to say that you need quantum mechanics to get out of the frozen formalism of sort of the general relativistic block universe. And this has nothing to do. I mean, the understanding how time is described by a constrained systems, it's something you do in the classical theory. And once you have done in the classical theory, you look in the quantum theory and you find Paige Waters, but you have already solved the problem. It's not entanglement per se that create times. It's
No. I agree. I agree with that. No, entanglement is important for other reasons. But
yeah, of course.
Okay, so let me ask the question I wanted to ask. So one thing I'm always curious about is in loop quantum gravity, you do use this Hamiltonian Jacobi formulation of general relativity. You said so in your talk yourself. And that entails using just the spatial part of the metric. Why don't you use the full four-dimensional? I mean, doesn't it taking away the time part? Doesn't it somehow restore for the time coordinate this impossibility of superpositions?
No, yeah, I think. I mean, that would require to go into details, of course. So, I don't want to do a chapter of a.
Okay.
So, Hamilton-Jacobi, it's one way of doing this. I mean, this same loop quantum gravity story can be formulated in a number of different languages. The key point is that it's analogous to when in electromagnetism, when you do QED. Or when you do quantum Maxwell, you say, okay, let me take A0 equals zero. You're not losing anything. Or let me gauge fix A0 and just work with the radiative mode. You're not losing anything. So it's just a gauge choice which can be formulated in a different manner. I think the clean way is to think not in terms of space and time, but in terms of bulk and boundary. The state is on the boundary. And the dynamics is in the bulk. So the transition amplitude are from boundary to boundary. So it's a constraint on the boundary values, if you want. And of course, it's convenient for technical and intuitive reasons to choose a boundary to be space-like. There's a lot of work to try to do time-like boundary. And then it's convenient to gauge fix to essentially the time gauge. So it's a gauge fixing. It's not a really making on anything.
Thank you.
Our next question is from Eric.
So, Carlo, if dynamics at the fundamental level is going to be unitary, presumably only some ways of splitting up the system to giving you an observable with respect to which you're going to use effectively the time variable for everything else. You won't get unitary evolution for every choice of observable. So is it the case that you always look for an observable such that relative to all the other observables, you get unitary evolution? And if that's right, does that somehow privilege some set of variables as being kind of more time-like than others at the fundamental level?
Okay, unitary means two different things. And the confusion about unitarity, I think it's a confusion between these two different meanings. You want probabilities to sum up to one. So you want to define transition amplitude such that the probabilities sum up to one. Otherwise, you don't know what you're talking about, right? So this is the basic requirement of unitarity. And of course, I've been rapid here in defining the amplitudes to go from the amplitude to the probability. There is a subtle discussion about normalization on which there's a large literature, and I think is well understood how to normalize things so to have a unitarity in this sense. So you give me something and probabilities are always relative probabilities in quantum mechanics. Given this, what is the probability of that? But of course, it's given with what is the probability of that as alternative to that and that and that. So that's where unitarity comes. So when you sum the alternative, you must get one. And this is, okay, the answer is yes. You have to, it doesn't restrict the kind of observable, that was your question, to consider, but it forces you to be careful about normalization. The second meaning of unitarity, which is often confused with the first one, in fact, there's an entire community that confuses these two meanings, is the following. Given time passes, we expect in non-relativistic quantum mechanics and in quantum Vasiliev-Minkowski space that there is a one parameter unitary family of evolution in T, okay? Just the Schrödinger evolution in non-relativistic quantum mechanics and a part of Poincaré invariance, the part, time part of Poincaré invariance, which is also unitary evolution in time. And so we expect that unitarity. Now that unitarity has no reason whatsoever to exist in general relativity in general. You might require it in general relativity in special cases. For instance, if you demand only to look at things which go Minkowski at infinity, then you have the time at infinity. But in general, when I'm doing the transition amplitudes from falling to a black hole to coming out of black hole, there is no T. There is no preferred time variable. So unitarity in that sense is not needed, okay? You want unitarity from scry minus to scry plus. Yes, of course. You want unitarity if you're asymptotic Minkowski up there. I think that's very good. It's very interesting. You cut away mini universe to come out, but inside the bulk transitions are unitary in the first sense, but not in the second sense, because there is no time. We heard Harvey this morning about energy conservation and the discussion at the end, the question of Marius and another person. There's no energy conservation in the local sense in general relativity, because unless there's a Killing field, because there's no time evolution T. So in the second sense, time evolution, unitarity in the second sense is there only if there is a background something invariant the time translation, and in quantum gravity there isn't in general. The second would restrict the kind of observables, because that was your question, but it's not a requirement.
Okay, good. That actually makes a lot of sense to me. Thank you very much.
All right. I think you have time for another quick question. Maybe Alex, you can ask your question.
Hi, Carlo. Thank you very much for the talk. Of course, I'm very sympathetic to everything you say, and I just wanted to push back a little bit on your comments about the Page-Wooters formalism. And it's
I knew it was
maybe you could have guessed why. But I mean, I would say that I'm just going to paste an excerpt from Feynman's lecture or try to in the chat. But he makes the argument that basically any physicist that's any good has six or seven different formulations of exactly the same physics. And the reason for this is its utility in guessing new theories. And I would say, I mean, I agree, formally, if you calculate probabilities, you're going to get out the same things. But I would say that maybe this Page and Wooters offers another perspective, maybe like Lorenzo was alluding to about correlations. And you know, that's the bread and butter of quantum information. So that got a lot of people excited. So just want to say that, you know, its utility might lie in giving us new ways to think about the problem. So,
I agree.
Okay.
I agree 100%. Far from me to saying that it's not interesting. It is interesting. It's another take. And again, Philip Hearn is very clear, because there's this three different ways of viewing the same thing. It's another reading of the same story. So to the extent one says, well, the other readings are wrong, this is the right one, it's bad, okay? But to the extent in which say, look, this relative evolution, if you look at it quantum mechanically,
yeah,
then I'm look, it's about entanglement, great.
Oh no! Sorry, I was just posting the quote from Feynman specifically.
But, I know. I always quote that sentence. Yeah.